Assassin. You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest. You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest.
What up, y'all? You're listening to Sports Talk with Trop, and I'm your host, Katie Trop. Well, before we get into things, I did want to announce that I have a new album going to be released on April 6th of 2024. The album is called Suck My Dick. It is my 7th solo album, so look out for that on April 6th. Starting next Friday, I'll actually be starting to release new singles, new videos, new merchandise, and we're also even going to debut a new intro track to Sports Talk with Trop. On my latest album, obviously I'm a huge-ass sports fan, if you didn't know, and so usually there are times I will dedicate specific songs to sports or certain athletes, and on my upcoming album, I do have a song dedicated to one of my favorite players of all time. I'm not going to tell you what sport they're from. I'm not going to tell you who it is. You're just going to have to find out when you find out. Not sure when we're going to drop this intro track. Of course, I will warn you beforehand. And that doesn't mean Jack Tatum's going anywhere. No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to alternate between both of them. But once I drop the new one, we'll probably put that in rotation for at least a month or so. And then we'll just rotate the two of them however I decide to do that. But look out for my next album, Suck My Dick. Yes, my album is titled Suck My Dick. That isn't even a joke. Not even a joke. That is what I really titled my next album. And the reason why I did that is because that's my favorite fucking saying. And you know what I said? Decided to do? I said, hey, why not name my next album Suck My Dick? And it's all about the cover, too. If you want to check out the cover, just go to my official website, katietrop.net, and you will see the official announcement up there. But yeah. New album coming April 6th, 2024. That's my birthday. That's why I'm dropping it on my birthday. It's a Saturday. That's not when you usually drop an album, but it's my birthday, and I could do what I want to, bitch. And that's what I wanted to do. I've always wanted to drop an album on my birthday, and since, you know, timing worked out with the when we recorded and getting the mixing and mastering done, so I decided I don't care if it's on a Saturday. I'm going to release my next album on my birthday, because it's not like I'm Taylor Swift. It's not like motherfuckers are sitting around like, oh my God, when's the next Katie Trop album coming out? No, nobody gives a shit. So it don't matter what day I release it on. But I hope you will take a listen over the next month at the new singles and the new video and blah, diddy, blah, blah, blah. Let's get into the sports and the week of the NBA that we had. Just a bunch of amazing performances from some great players. Luka Doncic still cannot be stopped. So let's get right into the week of the NBA. On Monday night, the Milwaukee Bucks, they have finally found their groove. They have finally started to get on a winning streak here. They're actually starting to play some really good, solid basketball. And they took out the Los Angeles Clippers 113-106. And there was no Giannis Antetokounmpo in this game. He actually was sitting out with an injury. And so it was the Dame Lillard show. He went off for 41 points, but the entire team actually played a really solid game. And that was a big win that they got over a decent Clippers team. Then the Lakers got a big win over the Oklahoma City Thunder, 116-104. Anthony Davis had a huge night. He had 24 points, 12 rebounds, and 3 blocks. Russell, he had 26 points, and then LeBron James also added in 19 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 assists. So big game. The Lakers actually played great defense that night, and it was really just Anthony Davis and D'Angelo Russell really just took over the game. LeBron just kind of had to sit back and just do his job and let the rest of the gang take over, and got a really big win over a really good team. Then on Tuesday night, we had a fun one between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Boston Celtics. Boston was on an 11-game winning streak, and that 11-game winning streak came to a halt against Cleveland. Cleveland ended up getting the win 105-104. There was no Donovan Mitchell in this game, which is very noteworthy because, you know, with the Celtics, they are a damn good team. They are the top-ranked team in the league. They have the best record. They are blowing everybody out of the water right now. But they just, you just can't trust them. And they have these weird losses. And while Cleveland is a good team, without Donovan Mitchell, they are really not that good. And Dean Wade is who stepped up for Cleveland. He actually had 23 points and had, I believe, 20 or 21 of those points in the fourth quarter. And he was really why they won. It was not Donovan Mitchell. So it's games like these, you look at the Boston Celtics and go, are you guys for real? Now, in the Eastern Conference, I definitely think they're for real. But going up against some of these Western Conference teams, there are a lot of questions. And we'll get to that a little bit later here in as we progress along in the week of the NBA. Then also on Tuesday night, the Phoenix Suns got a huge win in overtime over the Denver Nuggets, 117-107. Kevin Durant went off. He had 35 points and 8 rebounds. And then Grayson Allen also added in 28 points to help Durant out. Unfortunately for the Suns, they were blowing out the Nuggets in this one and then completely fell apart in the fourth quarter. Lucky for them, they were able to take it into overtime and just absolutely dominate in overtime. But the Phoenix Suns' issue this entire season so far has been the fourth quarter. They have fallen apart so many times, and they were really legitimately lucky in this one to take it into overtime and really just change their mindset. I don't know what's going on with them. It's even beyond the injuries, because even when they're healthy, it's the fourth quarter where they just completely falter. And they almost did it in this one, but lucky for them, they stepped it up in overtime, played great, played solid, and Kevin Durant was not losing this one, and they did not. Then on Wednesday night, we had the Golden State Warriors. As I was saying, the Milwaukee Bucks started to put it together, but not in this game. This was a blowout by the Warriors, 125-90. As a matter of fact, it was one of their biggest blowouts in their franchise's history. Steph Curry had a huge night. He had 29 points, 8 rebounds, and 5 assists. And I mean, just from the jump, this game was not close at all. I actually turned it off. I was watching it at first, and then just Golden State was just dominating from basically the tip-off. It was a really pathetic game from the Milwaukee Bucks, and that's what I mean with this team is they put it together, but then they just completely fall off the face of the earth. And the Golden State Warriors are not really that good of a team this season. They've had their moments, but they're not really that good. And they handled their business against Milwaukee. Then also on Wednesday night, the Sacramento Kings had a huge game against the Los Angeles Lakers, got the win 130-120. De'Aaron Fox went off for 44 points. Domantas Sabonis, he had a huge triple-double with 16 points, 20 rebounds, and 12 assists. And then LeBron James actually ended up leaving in the fourth quarter in this one with an injury. Doesn't look like it's going to be anything serious, but he did leave midway through the fourth, which was, I mean, disappointing as a fan, of course, and a lot of people were dogging him on it, but also at the same time, we don't know what kind of injury he's suffering from, and, you know, I don't think LeBron really enjoys losing, so it's not like he wanted to walk off the court and say, peace out, motherfuckers, take this one. No, I don't think it was anything like that. I legitimately think he was more than likely injured in that moment. And then also in some unfortunate news on Wednesday, Karl-Anthony Towns ended up tearing his meniscus in his knee. He is going to be out at least a month. The guy has been having a phenomenal season. As also the Minnesota Timberwolves, they've been one of the best teams in the Western Conference, and he's part of the reason why. Now, lucky for them, they still have Anthony Edwards and Rudy Gobert, who've really been the driving force of this team. But Karl-Anthony Towns has put up some numbers. He's been making a huge difference for this team in both points and in the paint. So it's going to be interesting to see if they kind of fall off here the next month or if they just keep it moving. And then when he comes back for the playoffs, they look all right. Then Thursday night, the Dallas Mavericks took care of business against the Miami Heat, 114-108. And Luka, the Don, had his fifth 30-plus point triple-double. that he is only the second player in the history of the NBA to have five straight 30-plus point triple-doubles. The only other person to do that was Russell Westbrook a few years ago when he was with the Oklahoma City Thunder. You'll remember he basically averaged a triple-double a game. So Luka closing in on that, he had a huge game, 35 points, 11 rebounds, 11 assists. The guy has been on fire. Now, unfortunately for him, a few of these triple-doubles have taken place in losses. So you really don't want to see that. But last night, it came in a huge win over the Miami Heat, who are a good team. But they really needed this. But, you know, you look at the Mavericks, and they're still like eighth in the league right now for as far as playoff positioning goes. So they'd only be in the play-in. So while Luka is having a fantastic year and really just making a case for himself for MVP, you look at this Dallas Mavericks team, and I just wouldn't be shocked if they end up being one of those really quick one-and-done type teams. And it sucks because Luka's just, he's such a great player to watch. And then to see him going on this tear right now, it's nice to see. And then Irving has also had a solid season as well. But outside of the two of them, it's pretty much just been the next man up. And they don't really have anybody else outside of those two to really take over a game. So if either one of them is locked down, pretty much it's going to be difficult for the Mavericks to even get past anybody in the playoffs. And they don't play defense well either. And that's always a problem come playoff time. And then speaking of triple-doubles, the Denver Nuggets took care of business against the Boston Celtics, the team I've been talking about. They had these weird losses, and last night was a weird one. I even said Monday, I would take the Denver Nuggets over the Boston Celtics. They play in the NBA Finals. I'm taking Denver all day. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be shocked if it was like a sweep or a five-game series win for the Nuggets. That's how much better I feel the Nuggets are, and they proved that last night with the 115-109 win over the Celtics, and they dominated them. They've actually now swept them in the regular season. Jokic, like I said, speaking of triple-doubles, had a triple-double last night, 32 points, 12 rebounds, and 11 assists, so of course was the maestro of this entire team, as he always is. But like I said, with the Celtics, they are a damn good team. They are obviously the best team in the Eastern Conference. You know, I've been ranking them pretty much number one all season long in my power rankings because you can't argue, really, in my opinion, against them being the number one team. But like I said, if they go up against the Denver Nuggets in the NBA Finals, I think Denver wins easily. And then you pit them against a few other teams in the Western Conference. And hell, they got beat last year. And they also got beat the year before. So while they have these nice, solid regular seasons, when it comes down to it, the Boston Celtics have not been able to answer the test. They just have not been able to pass the test against really good teams, even in the regular season. So like I said, we'll see what happens with the Celtics come postseason, because they've had a couple of bad losses this past week. And last night, Denver just dominated. All right, moving on to UFC. We do have a few solid matchups this week at UFC 299. We've got Sean O'Malley, the bantamweight title holder right now at 17-1 versus Chito Vera, bringing in his 23-8-1 record. As a matter of fact, Sean O'Malley's one and only loss is to Chito Vera. That happened back in 2020. So both of these guys are in completely different phases of their career, because that was 4 years ago. In my opinion, Vera was a much better fighter at the time. Now, don't get me wrong, he's actually one of my favorite fighters to watch. I just really enjoy his style of fighting, and he's just a really scrappy motherfucker. But he does have some really bad losses as well, and especially as of late, he's had his ups and he's had his downs. Whereas O'Malley, when they first fought, he was kind of on the come up. He was more of a dude you heard about, but you didn't really know what he was about. Now he's one of the faces of the UFC for damn sure. And he's the title holder now. So this is actually for the belt. This is for it all at this point in time. And like I said, Vera is his only loss. Now O'Malley, ever since then, even in the post-fight conference, he doesn't believe he lost that last fight, even though he lost that last fight. Vera knocked him out in the first round, at the end of the first round. Basically, what ended up happening is Vera had this nice kick, because that's what Vera, that's what he was all about, was kicks. He just was a kick-ass motherfucker, and he actually ended up kicking O'Malley in the shin, and it pretty much, from what it sounds like, numbed up his leg and kind of took away his stance. He fell down, and then Vera was just able to get him on the ground and pound and elbowed the fuck out of dude's face, and they stopped the fight, and Vera got the win. And ever since then, O'Malley has been talking shit. He has been acting like he did not lose that fight, and he absolutely lost that fight. And Vera kicked his ass. He absolutely kicked his ass. So it's going to be an interesting fight to see. I am going with O'Malley in this one just because, like I said, O'Malley's on the come up right now. He's the title holder. He's got a very solid overall game here. Whereas Vera, like I said, he's been up and down as of late. Now, if anybody can do it, it's definitely Vera. I would like to see him get the win, just because, like I said, I really enjoy Vera's fighting style, but I'm leaning towards O'Malley in this one. Then we do have a couple of other matchups as well in UFC 299. We have Dustin Poirier bringing his 29-8 record against St. Denis, who's got a 13-1 record. This is a guy on the come up against an OG in the game, and Poirier. Poirier has also had his moments where he's been up and down, especially as of late, like Vera. And St. Denis is the guy on the come up. I feel like this is going to be a good fight. It's going to probably go down to the end and come down to the cards. I'm leaning towards St. Denis in this one just because the guy has been money as of late. You know, that's a 13-1 record, really solid record. Poirier should make this a solid-ass fight, but he's not as consistent as he's been in the past, so I'm going with St. Denis in that one. And then the third matchup that I think is going to be really solid is going to be Peter Yan bringing his 16-5 record against Song Yadong, also one of my favorite names ever of all time, Song Yadong, bringing his 21-7-1 record into the ring, or into the octagon. And Peter Yan, he used to have a lot of promise. He really used to be a guy everybody thought was going to be the face of the UFC at one point, and he's kind of fallen off as of late. Yadong, on the other hand, he is a killer. This guy, he's also one of my favorite fighters to watch. I do think this is going to be a slugfest between these two guys because they are heavy hitters, heavy kickers as well. I'm leaning towards Yadong, not only because I love his name, but because I do think he's the better fighter, and he's got cement bricks for fists, and I just kind of see him taking out Yan at some point in this one. I'm gonna go three rounds in that one. Yadong gets the knockout. All right, moving on to this week's Trop 10 list. You'll remember last week I did the Trop 10 NFL GOATs of the 1960s. So this week we are moving on to the Trop 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s. And this was a really difficult list for me to rank because there are so many good-ass players from the 70s. But I'm also right now, I'm on Super Bowl. I watched 24 last night. So I'm going on to 25. And so I'm in the 80s right now. And that's going to be next week's list. And I'm already like, who the fuck am I putting where? Now, I already know my number one and number two for sure. You probably would be able to guess, but I'll wait till next week. I already know who they're going to be. But after that, I'm like, whoa, there's going to be so many guys to choose from. It's going to be a difficult list for me to whittle together. But this list from the 70s, also pretty difficult to do because this is a quarterback-heavy list for sure, but there are so many damn good players from the 70s. It was hard to leave out some of the ones I had to leave out, but here are the Trop 10 NFL GOATs from the 1970s, beginning with number 10. I can't believe I had to put him in number 10, but I did, and that is Bob Greasy, the quarterback of the Miami Dolphins. He played from 1967 to 1980. He is a two-time Super Bowl champion. He won Super Bowl 7 and 8. He actually went to 6, so he went to 3 straight Super Bowls. He also played for the only undefeated team ever, the 1972 Dolphins. He's a two-time first all-team, 1971, 1977. He led the league in touchdowns in 1977. his career numbers. He had 25,092 passing yards and 192 passing touchdowns. And this guy was just an Iron Man. He played through so many injuries. Actually, in the undefeated season for the Dolphins, it's crazy when you actually look back on that 1972 season, because Bob Greasy ended up getting injured early on in the season, so he didn't even play the majority of the regular season. He got injured. I can't recall who was his backup. Was it Earl Morrill? I think it was Earl Morrill, as a matter of fact, because Morrill was the backup to Johnny Unitas for a while, also took over in a backup role when Unitas started getting injured. Shula was his coach. So yeah, I'm almost positive it was Morrill who took over for him. In the regular season, but then once they got to hit the postseason, that's when Greasy was good and ready to go. During that undefeated year, Greasy was out a lot of the regular season, which is just crazy to think about. But he battled through a lot of injuries throughout his career, but he was an Iron Man, and he was one of the top quarterbacks of this era, which is just crazy because, like I said, this is a quarterback-centric list. Now, I think it's only three that are on the list, but even... Yeah, three. Three are on this list. But even these three, I was like, shit, I got to leave you out. Oh, my God, I got to leave you out. So there's a lot of good-ass players in the 70s. And Bob Greasy was one of the top quarterbacks of this era. And he's at number 10. So that's pretty crazy. Then at number 9 on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, Terry Bradshaw, quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers. He played from 1970 to 1983. He's a four-time Super Bowl champion. He won Super Bowl IX, Super Bowl X, Super Bowl XIII, and Super Bowl XIV with the Pittsburgh Steelers. They were they were back-to-back champs, obviously, two times. He is a two-time Super Bowl MVP. He also won the MVP in 1978. He was a first-team All-Pro in 1978. He led the league in touchdowns twice in 1978 and in 1982. His career statistics in passing yards, 27,989 passing yards, 212 passing touchdowns with 2,257 rushing yards and 32 rushing touchdowns. And speaking of Iron Man, Terry Bradshaw also was an Iron Man. This guy took some crazy fucking hits throughout his career. A lot of people like to talk down on Terry Bradshaw, like to kind of act like he didn't play a huge role in this team. And in my opinion, there's only one player from this Pittsburgh Steelers team that I actually put on this list, because I felt like you had to definitely include some Steelers on this list, because this was the team of the 70s, the Steelers. They were the team of the 70s. They dominated the 70s. Nobody dominated the 70s like the Pittsburgh Steelers did. So it was 100% factual. I had to put a couple Steelers on this list. I could have made a top 10 list of just Steelers if I wanted to, but you know, they weren't the only people in this era. So I put Terry Bradshaw on here because he was the workhorse of this offense. He basically was the beginning of this 70s team in this 70s era. And so like I said, a lot of people like to talk down on him, kind of like they did with Bart Starr in the 60s. Oh my God, he had all these great players. Yeah, well, guess what, people? I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've ever looked over rosters from Super Bowl champion teams, but they're pretty goddamn good. Usually, that's the case. You know why? Because teams win championships, not fucking individuals. Teams win championships. And just because Terry Bradshaw was surrounded by Hall of Famers doesn't mean he wasn't one. And he was an integral part of this team. It was difficult for me to put him down at 9. I had to put him down at 9 on this list just because there are just this 70s era was full of talent. And it wasn't just quarterbacks who dominated. And like I said, there's one player on this Steelers team who's actually ranked above Terry Bradshaw in this one, and he's one of the greatest defenders of all time. So yeah, get ready for that one. But Terry Bradshaw, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time too. That dude deserves all the praise for his career. And Terry, don't ever let anybody talk you down, because I've heard interviews with Terry Bradshaw that he suffered from depression because people have basically said he was like the loser of the team. And it's like, fuck no. Not anybody could have just played in that role. You did it. You won 4 Super Bowls. so they can go fuck themselves. You also want an MVP, for Christ's sake. You don't win the league MVP by being just a little fucking role player on a team. No, you were the quarterback of the 1970s dynasty. So Terry Bradshaw, that dude's a bad motherfucker in my book. Then at number 8 on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, speaking of bad motherfuckers, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said there was 3 quarterbacks on this. No, there's 3 quarterbacks to start the list, and then there's 4 quarterbacks total on this list. Here is 3rd quarterback in the row, and in my opinion, this guy is such a phenomenal quarterback. One of the just watching him, his game, and he played for a long ass time too. I could have put him in the 60s as well. That's how long this guy's career was. But when I watch his highlights, I'm just like, damn, this guy was a bad motherfucker. And you could tell he was the key for this team. And that guy's name is Fran Tarkenton. Now, he was first drafted by the Minnesota Vikings as a quarterback from 1961 to 66. He would then get traded to the New York Giants. He'd have a brief stint there, and then he would come back to the Minnesota Vikings from 1972 to 1978. And he played some of the most consistent football ever. And even in, he lost a bunch of Super Bowls, unfortunately. But even in those Super Bowl losses, it wasn't on him. Trust me, you watch those Super Bowls back, which I did, and I'm like, he was the only thing that kind of kept them in it in those games. It's unfortunate for him that he lost so many, but I mean, that's just the way it goes. But he was insane to watch. When you watch Fran Tarkenton highlights, you just, at least me, I am in awe. His career numbers, he has passing yards, 47,003 passing yards, and 342 passing touchdowns with 3,674 rushing yards and 32 rushing touchdowns. Now, I know the rushing quarterback kind of feels like it just came about when Michael Vick hit the league, or even when Steve Young just hit the league. No, y'all, you need to go back and watch the 60s and 70s shit, and you will find out that Fran Tarkenton has been running around like a motherfucker since the fucking 60s. That dude invented running the football as a quarterback. And not only did he do that, but just watching how precise he was with his passes, he was just, he's just crazy to watch. Just no lie. Through the air, on the ground, he just made play after play after play. He was the MVP in 1975, Offensive Player of the Year in 1975. He was the first team All-Pro in 1975. As you could tell, the 1975 season was his year. He led the league in passing yards in 1978, and then he also led the league in passing touchdowns in, you guessed it, 1975. So Fran Tarkenton, I could have put him on the list in the 60s, but I saved him for the 70s, especially because I feel like that's what he's most known for, is his time in the 70s with the Minnesota Vikings. But this guy was a bad, bad motherfucker. And talking about running quarterbacks, he started that gangsta shit, and this is the motherfucking thanks he gets. Then at number 7 on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, Ron Yari. He played offensive tackle for the Minnesota Vikings and blocked for the said Fran Tarkenton. He played from 1968 to 1981. His entire career with the Vikings. He was a champion in 1969. He was a 6-time first-team All-Pro from 1971 through 1976, so 6 times straight. This guy was basically one of the greatest offensive linemen ever to play the game. He only missed 2 games in his entire career. He ended up playing 207 games, starting 180 of them, and had 2 fumble returns, or 2 fumble recoveries, and he was just the epitome of consistency. And like I said, he blocked for Fran Tarkenton, and they actually had some pretty good running backs as well throughout his tenure. So Ron Yari, just, he was that dude back in the 70s. Speaking of those dudes, at number 6 on my top 10 NFL GOATs, That would be Jack Youngblood, the defensive end of the Los Angeles Rams from 1971 to 1984. His career, his sacks, not all of them are counted because he played half in that era where they didn't count sacks and then half when they did. He ended up with 151 and a half total career sacks. He had 10 fumble recoveries and 2 safeties. He's a 5-time first-team All-Pro from 1974 to 1976, also in 1978 and 1979. He led the league twice in sacks in 1974 and 1979. He is also notoriously known for playing on a broken leg in the playoffs and in the Pro Bowl in 1979. So as you could tell, 1979 was his year of domination. He actually took over for one of the other greatest defensive ends of all time, who was also mentioned in my 1960s GOATs, Deacon fucking Jones. He took over for Deacon Jones. How do you go from Deacon Jones to Jack Youngblood? Well, you do when you're the Los Angeles Rams. And Jack Youngblood, one of the most insane, crazy motherfuckers, and just dominated on defense in the 70s. Then at number 5 on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, another crazy motherfucker, and his name is Alan Page. He played defensive tackle for the Minnesota Vikings from 1967 to 1978, and then played for the Chicago Bears from 1978 to 1981. In his career, he also played in that era where they didn't count all his sacks, but these don't actually count, but this is how many he had, 148 and a half career sacks. 3 safeties, 2 interceptions, 23 fumble recoveries, and 3 touchdowns. He still to this day holds an NFL record of 2 safeties in one season. He won a championship in 1969. He was the first defensive NFL MVP in 1971. He was a 2-time defensive player of the year in 1971 and 1973. 5-time first team, all team, 1970, 1971, and then 1973 through 75. And when you talk about dominating defenses, this Minnesota Vikings defense was literally one of the most dominant defenses of all time, and he was the driving force of them all. Of also weird career note, usually when a guy retires from the NFL, his career could go many different ways. You could be successful like a Roger Staubach, for example, and you know, you retire and get into real estate and that's where you make all your riches. Or you could be Antonio Brown and just be a fucking whack-ass motherfucker who has no future in sight as anything other than a jackass. Alan Page, on the other hand, he went the Roger Staubach route and he actually ended up getting his law degree and would become a lawyer and eventually end up on the Minnesota Supreme Court as a judge. How fucking insane is that? He's a retired freaking judge now. So not only was he one of the greatest defenders of all time, dude takes his career to a completely different realm and ends up on the Minnesota Supreme Court. How crazy is that? Then at number 4 on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, O.J. Simpson, running back of the Buffalo Bills, played for the Bills from 1969 to 1977, also ended his career with the San Francisco 49ers, but nobody really remembers him for that. Of course, most people these days remember him for something much worse, you know, stealing his memorabilia, right? That's what we all know him for these days, right? Not slitting throats or anything like that. Anyways, O.J. Simpson was a fantastic football player. Regardless of what you think about him, regardless of what kind of a human being he is, I know this is going to be upsetting to certain people, but this list is not about who you are as a person. I don't believe in that kind of shit, especially in the sports world. I don't really believe in it in the entertainment world. If I am entertained by you, I don't actually care who you are as a human being. And I could completely separate who you are as a human being from whatever form of entertainment you are offering to me. And actually, all of us are like that in one way, shape, or form. It's just everybody has their certain line. And, you know, O.J. Simpson's a very polarizing person, especially if you grew up in the 90s when the O.J. trial was going on. He was very polarizing. And so he's a polarizing topic. And the NFL kind of likes to act like he doesn't exist. But guess what? I know he existed because he was one of the greatest running backs of all time, and he dominated the 1970s era. So I'm sorry, he is on my list at number four. And honestly, he could have been higher if I really wanted to put him there. It's just he didn't get opportunities to play in the postseason. As a matter of fact, he's only played in one playoff game. So we didn't really get to see what he could do in the postseason. But I'm also not going to hold that against him because it's not like it was his fault that his teams sucked. As a matter of fact, he was the only bright, shining star on these Buffalo Bills teams during his run, if you will. But when you watch O.J. Simpson run, it's beauty. This is what a running back should look like, in my opinion. And he ended up with his career stats of 11,236 rushing yards, 61 rushing touchdowns. Through the air, he had 2,142 receiving yards and 14 receiving touchdowns. He was the MVP in 1973. He was the Offensive Player of the Year in 1973. He's a five-time first-team All-Pro from 1972 to 1976, so 5 years in a row. He was the rushing champion four times in 1972, 1973, 1975, and 1976. He led the league in touchdowns twice in 1973 and 1975. He was the scoring leader in 1975. In 1973, he became the first running back ever to rush for over 2,000 yards. He ended up with 2,003 yards, and he only did it in 14 games because he played in an era where you only played 14 games. So the running backs that have eclipsed the 2,000-yard rushing mark for whatever season they do it in, they all did it in more than 14 games. So OJ is the only running back to ever do that in 14 games. Also in 1976, he set the all-time leading rushing mark in a game for rushing for 273 yards and two touchdowns. And then in that 1973 season in which he won the MVP, he averaged, this is what he averaged per game, 143.1 yards per game. So I'm sorry, y'all can hate on who he is as a person, which, by the way, he probably is a scumbag as a human being from what he has presented himself to be. But as I said, I can separate the two of them. And watching him on the field, I've watched myself plenty of O.J. Simpson highlights. And every time I watch O.J. Simpson on the field, I am in awe. He is exactly what a running back should have been. I can't imagine what it would have been like if O.J. Simpson would have played for either like the Dolphins, the Steelers, or the Cowboys in this 70s era, because those were basically the teams that dominated. Shit, if he played for one of those teams, we'd probably be talking about O.J. Simpson as one of the greatest running backs of all time, and you wouldn't even be able to try and delete it from the world as much as you like to. Even though he didn't win championships, he dominated this era. He was the running back of this era, and absolutely one of the greatest to do it ever. Then at number three on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, Walter Payton, running back of the Chicago Bears. Yeah, I can't believe I had to put him at number three, by the way. It was hard. Actually, my top three in this was really difficult for me to kind of shuffle who was going to go where, because, you know, Walter Payton is arguably the greatest running back of all time. You know, that's why I put him above OJ, because OJ was fantastic too. But Walter Payton, he won a Super Bowl, and this Chicago Bears team was in contention every single year for the Super Bowl that Walter Payton was on this team. And he was the reason why they were so good. He was the bright, shining star of this team, and he was the face of the league as well. He played from 1975 to 1987. He won Super Bowl 20, which was in the 80s, but still, he dominated the 70s. He ended up with a career rushing of 16,726 yards, which was the leading rusher, which was a record at the time of his retirement, which was eclipsed by Emmitt Smith ultimately. He would have 116 career touchdowns, 4,538 receiving yards, and 15 receiving touchdowns. He was the MVP of the 1977 year, Offensive Player of the Year in 1977. He was a five-time first-team All-Pro 1976, 1977, 1980, 84, and 85. So as you could tell, he dominated in both the 70s and 80s. So don't be surprised if he actually potentially makes the 1980s list as well, because he dominated basically until the day he retired. He probably could have played a couple more seasons if he wanted to, but he just didn't. And also, you know, the reason why I had to put him on this list specifically is his 1977 season is obviously a legendary year. And not only did he win the MVP and Offensive Player of the Year, he was the first team. He also led the league in rushing in 1977. He led the league in touchdowns in 1977. Also, he would end up breaking that O.J. Simpson record for the most rushing yards in a game in 1977. He broke that record with 275 yards in one game. So the 77 year was just a big year for Walter Payton. So that's why he definitely had to be on the 70s list for sure. Like I said, don't be surprised if he makes the 80s list. He may or may not. But in the 70s, he absolutely dominated. And like I said, it was really tough to put him at number three because he was the all-time leading rusher. Like I said, when you're breaking down running backs, just overall, Sweetness was the dude. And he really was the face of the league at this time. They did have a few faces of the league, but when you speak on Walter Payton, I mean, there's a freaking award named after him, for Christ's sake. So that's kind of Walter Payton's impact on the league as a whole. Then at number two on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s, Mean Joe Greene, defensive tackle of the Pittsburgh Steelers, played his entire career with the Steelers from 1964 to 1981. He is a four-time Super Bowl champion, won 9, 10, 13, and 14, and was the face of the Steelers team. Like I said, I knew I had to put a couple players from the Steelers team on here. I already talked about Terry Bradshaw, but Mean Joe Greene was the Pittsburgh Steelers. From the day they drafted him, by the way, he was the Pittsburgh Steelers. As a matter of fact, he won Rookie of the Year in 1969 when he was drafted. I'm sorry, did I say he played from 64 to 81? I should have said he played from 69 to 81. My pen kind of missed the top of the ink, and it made it look like a 4. He played from 69 to 81. And was the defensive rookie of the year in 69. He also was a 2-time defensive player of the year in 1972 and 74. He was a 5-time first team All-Pro from 1972 through 74, and then also in 77 and 79. His career also, career sacks not really counted because he played in that era, but he had ended up with 77 and a half sacks, 16 fumble recoveries, and one interception. And I know some of his stats don't sound as amazing like Jack Youngblood, or hell, even Alan Page, but when you talk about this 70s Steelers team, we all know Mean Joe Greene was the face of this team. He was the face of the league at the time. He basically was the first football player to be in that Coca-Cola ad where he throws the kid his jersey, which we still talk about in 2024, for Christ's sake. So it was actually really difficult for me to not put him at number one because this team, this Steelers team, they did dominate the 70s. But my number one, I obviously has a tiny bit of bias to it, but at the same time, his domination is just as great too. But Mean Joe Greene was the face of that Steelers team. He was called Mean, for Christ's sake, so he was insane on defense. But also, there were so many other great defenders on this team. That's why he only had 77 and a half sacks, because he would have had more if he was the only guy on this defense. But there was more sacks to go around between other players, so he didn't need to dominate the way he did. But I think we all know who was the face of that franchise at the time and who was really the face of the league at that time, and it had to have been Mean Joe Greene. Now my number one on my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s. I just said it. There's a tiny, tiny bit of bias in this one. But really, at the end of the day, you take a look at the overall career. You take a look at his dominance. You take a look at the way he played. You take a look at how he was in the league. And it's really, he at least has to be in your top three. I don't care what anybody says. Of the 70s era, this guy has to be in your top three. He happens to be my number one. And that is Roger Staubach, quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. So yes, that is where my tiny bit of bias goes in there, but I'm sorry, this motherfucker dominated the 1970s. He played from 1969 to 1979, spent his entire career with the Cowboys. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny to see the career of Roger Staubach. You know, he was in the military. So he had to serve his 4 years in the military before he would even could play in the NFL. And he hits the NFL, and Tom Landry kind of has doubts about him. He didn't really like his style of play. He felt that he ran too much and didn't want to sit in the pocket and be a pocket passer. So there was this time period, basically throughout the majority of Staubach's career, it was a rotating quarterbacks. He was not usually the starting quarterback. Basically, Landry he relented. Basically, every time he started Staubach, he couldn't not start him because Staubach was just that fucking good. So Staubach, two-time Super Bowl champion. He won Super Bowl VI and Super Bowl XII. He was a Super Bowl MVP of Super Bowl VI. He went to 4 overall, but unfortunately lost 2 of those to the Steelers. He led the league in touchdowns in 1973. His career stats, 22,700 passing yards, 153 touchdowns, 2,264 rushing yards, and 20 rushing touchdowns. He was just so reliable. He was, when you actually do watch highlights of the 70s, when you actually just pay attention to what was going on in football at the 70s, he was the face of the league. Him and Mean Joe Green were pretty much the dudes. And then, of course, Walter Payton as well. But Roger Staubach, he was the quarterback. Everybody loved watching him. Everybody wanted to be him. He just played Roger the Dodger, man. He just was crazy. Like, talking about Tarkenton and the way he ran, Roger Staubach was the exact same way. You just couldn't stop the dude. If you had his receivers locked down in coverage, well, you better have a spy watching him because the guy could take off at any minute. And he was also an iron man. He would take the hits. He would play even injured. He basically just had to be taken out of the game and medically told you cannot play, basically, if he was ever taken out of a game. And when he played for the Cowboys, they were successful the entire time. And just he really dominated the 70s, so he had to be at number one for me. Like I said, I feel like the top three, Walter Payton and Joe Green and Roger Staubach, you really can shuffle any one of them and make them number one. But for me, like I said, there's a tiny bit of Dallas Cowboys bias in there because I'm a Cowboys fan. But you take a look at the 70s and the league in the 70s, Staubach dominated. Staubach was that dude. And it's not his fault he played in an era with some really damn good teams like the Steelers, like the Vikings, with really damn good defenses. He also had damn good defense as well. But Roger Staubach, he was the leader of one of the best franchises of the 1970s. So my top 10 NFL GOATs of the 1970s was 10, Bob Greasy, 9, Terry Bradshaw, 8, Fran Tarkenton, 7, Ron Yari, 6, Jack Youngblood, 5, Alan Page, 4, O.J. Simpson, 3, Walter Payton, 2, Mean Joe Green, and number 1, Roger Staubach. So that is the top 10 this week. Enjoy the weekend of sports, and I will talk to you fools on Monday.